The Right Honorable Paul Heen, Order Extraordinary, official celebrant of 4th of July from Dallas, Texas. The Professor Paul Heen.
Friends, countrymen, the 4th of July is different at Holden Village. Last year, for example, it fell completely on the 3rd of July, to the utter consternation of the rest of the nation. Here the fact was accepted in the spirit of our director, calmly and chaotically. This year, careful calculations by a team of experts established beyond reasonable doubt that the 4th of July fell half on the 3rd, half on the 4th of July. These calculations, for those of you who are interested, were based upon the precise time of the vernal equinox, the date of Easter in the Greek Orthodox Church, and the schedule of the Lady of the Lake. But the 4th of July is different at Holden Village also in other respects. In most of the United States, it is a secular holiday, like Flag Day, Washington's Birthday, Christmas. Here, however, its religious meaning is always emphasized, first invented, then emphasized. Those who invent religious meanings are called new theologians. Their theology is called the new morality. The new morality is familiar and beloved by all Lutherans under its traditional name, sin. Or in theological language, doth lust. But I digress from my subject. What religious meaning have we discovered, or in theological language, stumbled over this year? Only here at Holden Village has the fact been recognized and pointed out that this year, the 4th of July, falls in 1967. That has never happened before. Interesting, you say, but hardly of religious significance. Aha, you do not probe deeply enough. You are like so many Americans who have been duped by communism and the new math. 1967. Do you not see? You don't. Let me write it for you in Jewish numerals. There. These were called Arabic numerals until last month when Nasser ceded them in return for permission to use the Suez Canal. Now, by the way, Nasser is also studying intensively the books of Moses to find out how he got the children of Israel out of Egypt. But again, I digress from my subject. 1967, notice carefully. If we place each preceding year in correspondence with the successive numerals of the Jewish system in reverse chronological order, 1966 becomes 1. 1965, 2, 1964, 3, and so forth. The calculations are laborious. I will not bore you with them. I've written out the complete proof here for any of you who are still familiar with the older mathematics. The upshot of the matter, of course, is that 1517 is 450. Now, 1517, as you all know, is the year in which Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg. And why did he do this? Was it, as we've been told, because someone swiped his scotch tape? No. 1,000 times no. It was because he wanted to found Holden Village. Now, I know what you're thinking. Luther was a Lutheran, and so is Holden Village. But that's hardly enough to justify calling him the founder of Holden Village. But justification is by faith, and faith is the evidence of things not seen, and none of you have seen the evidence for which I am arguing. My conclusion is therefore theologically unavoidable. The web of historical evidence, or as we scholars like to say, the tissue, may be drawn very tight. I present only a small part of the case. What was Luther's father? A copper smelter. Moreover, and this is the clincher, The fumes from the smelting clung to his clothes, and his family always talked about finding for him a place apart. Today, we commemorate the fulfillment of that dream and the anniversary of our nation's birth. Now, some of you have no doubt been wondering why I was chosen to do this and why I have selected this garb for the occasion. I am dressed in the traditional family costume of my revered ancestor, Frederick the Wise, Elector of Saxony, friend and protector of Martin Luther. Frederick the Wise combined in his person political and religious leadership, thus symbolizing our twin concerns on this day. You are indeed honored to have one of his descendants with you. Paul the 17th, as I am known by my children, or Paul the Wise, as I am usually spoken of. Such as when my wife says, "You know everything, don't you?" Or as people even here frequently say in astonishment at my lectures, "How come you got all the answers?" The explanation lies in my ancestry, descended on my father's side from Frederick the Wise and on my mother's side from Lyndon Johnson. But again, I digress from the subject of this morning's remarks. We have too long, far too long, supposed that there must be no mixing of church and state, of religion and politics. We have not allowed our overflowing religious zeal to permeate and shape the structure of our national life. We have adopted the false Baptist principles that neither church and state nor whiskey and soda should be mixed. Our talent has therefore lain rusting. Our energies have been wastefully circumscribed, and marvelous accomplishments in the church have not been brought to the service of the nation. Consider just a few examples. Take the plight of our cities. Overcrowding, slums, congestion. Lutherans have shown the way. They have removed their churches from the cities to relieve the crowding. Racial conflict is another urban problem. Again, our Lutheran churches have shown that racial conflict can be avoided by excluding Negroes from the church. And once established in the suburbs, our churches have gone forward like a mighty army. What the cities most need today, our suburban churches have seen as their first responsibility: larger parking lots. The strikes and the lockouts which plague our nation could have been avoided if the Missouri Synod had only been willing to extend its theological principle into the political realm. No unionism of any sort. We have much to contribute to national health, which we have not given. Would not the common cold be brought under control if our whole nation imitated the Lutheran contempt for indiscriminate fellowship? I am well aware, as you must be, of the spiteful canard often voiced against us who are more devout than others, that we have practiced cruelty in the name of religion. The burning of witches is a favorite libel against us. We know, however, that we were only trying to bring also to sinners the delights of the sauna. It was a mere administrative error on the part of our forebears that caused them first to plunge the witches' heads underwater and then roast them. This unfortunate reversal of sequence has been corrected subsequently, and you may observe it any evening behind the dining hall. Now, all of these critics ignore the massive contributions of Lutheranism to American life. Let me review just a few of these for you, involving ancestors of people familiar to all of us. It was an ancestor of our own, Carol Hinderly, who kept the British from taking Philadelphia during the Revolutionary War. His detailed directions on how to reach the city were carefully followed by General Cornwallis, who wound up in Cincinnati. I lost the shirt. But it was an ancestor of our own, Harvey Wingee, who diverted the British at Bunker Hill by wearing his wife's measurements on his T-shirt, 62, 48, 64. I had one here. It was in Concord in 1778 that Werner Jansen's Bermuda shorts inspired Betsy Ross. The great American game of baseball was invented by Abner Rosenauer, who thought he was playing volleyball. Roman Catholic historians have perpetuated the myth that we seized most of the Western United States in war. This is false. It was given to us by the Mexican government in response to a suggestion by James Polk's Lutheran Secretary of State, Western Priebe, that New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona would make a fine church retreat center. Utah itself was settled by the Mormon Brigham Young and the Lutheran Darrell Lundy, both leading advocates of polygamy. Snow-capped mountains were invented by Howard Hong, who thought only his hairdresser knew. And Al Swihart invented fruited plains served with lemon sauce. I could go on and on with this recital, but why should I strain your patience? History is of importance only insofar as it nerves us for the tasks of the present. We must, therefore, refresh our spirits, renew our zeal, strengthen our determination, steel our resolve, sharpen our vision, and gird our loins. Many a proud people has been caught with its pants down for failure to gird its loins. But how shall we gird? Where in the village can a man get a belt when he needs one? The lift that we need is not the lift that we have, for the one that we have is full of nuts, and it contains more mice than men. There are even traitors in our midst, the full depths of whose depravity has not been recognized. We have been correctly warned that Karen Shager wanted to be in charge of the only Holden Village mail, but what have we done about it? We have allowed her to be mistress of all the males. What have we done about those who refuse to serve, or who serve out of bounds or into the net? Nothing. In a church camp, we have encouraged setups. We have allowed people to spike their setups. We have allowed continual overreaching by HR. We even laughed last night as he developed another pair of arms. We listen to the theology of Walter Bowman when even his beard is red. We allow Beanie Lundholm to plant red geraniums all over the village. Only our deer have enough patriotism to eat them. And we who should love them for this, step upon the deer continually and wipe them from our feet. As Cicero proclaimed, O tempora, O feces. Worse yet, the subversive plumbing and sanitation crew puts big lumps of fluoride in our water and tries to pass it off casually by saying it's only dirt and grass. Ha! Who ever heard of dirt and grass in drinking water? In the very schoolhouse, our children make internationalist posters. The schoolhouse itself is called the Activity Center, and we know why. It is the Un-American Activity Center. I know what all of you are thinking in your hearts at this moment. How long must we endure? Does he think, like Samson, that the Philistines can be slain with the jawbone of an ass? I leave that question with you.